Shooter. And we will get started. So, does anyone want to get started with the first question? I can open it up, but does anyone like to go first?
I have a general question, so I maybe we'll just jump in and ask it, if that's okay. So I'm curious about why the title Emancipation after Hegel. The reason I'm asking is because I found in the Hegel dictionary pages on the word freedom, but not on emancipation. And even in the book, you talked about Marx using emancipation, and it seemed like a political or kind of a politicized term. So if you could talk about that a bit, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, that's an interesting. No one's ever asked me that question before. I've been asked hundreds of questions about this book. So I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that I'm not sure what I was thinking about when I came up with the title, but and you're right that there's not even a Hegel doesn't even use a German equivalent that's even close to emancipation, Freiheit, which, as you pointed out, freedom is very common in his work. I guess I was trying to, so I feel like the basis for his thinking is to try to integrate the French Revolution and the ideals of the French Revolution into philosophy. And so emancipation was really my word for those, for the bring together of freedom, equality, and solidarity. And I couldn't put all those three words in the title, so emancipation to me like summed up those three words. So I felt like the and like you said, I think Marx is thought of as much more of a, I mean, this is a truism, what I'm going to say, is thought of as much more of a political thinker than Hegel. And I one of the things I was trying to do was not so much reverse that and say Hegel's the real political thinker and Marx isn't, but to say Hegel is a political thinker in his own right, not just in the political book, The Philosophy of Right, but it's infused throughout his philosophy. And so the term emancipation was for me the way to make that clear. So that's really why. I mean, it was really this attempt to try to be true to the importance of the French Revolution in his thought, and the Haitian Revolution as well. That, I mean, Susan Buckmore sort of wrote a great book called Hegel and Haiti, where she talks about how the Haitian Revolution almost it was equivalent for him in importance to the French. So I feel like that aspect of his thinking gets doesn't get hadn't gotten enough in emphasis. And so I was trying to I used the term just for that, basically. Yeah, I'm not even sure if this was my original title. I think Hegel wasn't I think that A Contradictory Revolution was the original title, and then something Hegel was in the subtitle. And so this is the press insisted on Hegel being in the actual title. So I think it was a bit of a compromise too. So, but that was what was driving that term, emancipation. It's a term I'm maybe overly fond of too, because of that, because the way I think it sums up the linkage of freedom, equality, and solidarity.
Yeah, and it also goes to what you were talking about with Christ on the cross, who, emancipated the people or Christians. So anyway, I was looking kind of throughout the book for a definition of emancipation, and it yeah, that answers that question. So that's really
Yeah, I think the Christian dimension, I think, is something that I mean, that's probably the thing that's most counterintuitive about this book, because most leftist readings of Hegel really, and I say this, of course, and the main idea in the book, that most leftist readings of Hegel de-emphasizes Christianity, and I really want to emphasize it. And I think that you're right, like the Christ on the cross is this figure of emancipation. And I think for him, like for Hegel, like emancipation is and I think this is like what happens with Christ, like God is in like God is this being of all powerful beyond is reduced to absolute humiliation. And so this like seeing oneself in what's absolutely foreign or other to oneself. Like that to me is what Hegel means by emancipation. I find that a really powerful way to think about things, because I think most of the time we think of Alien kind of like the movie, like it's this horrible monster that we want to avoid at all costs. And I think Hegel thinks that the opposite of that, that you have to see yourself in the alien. And that's I think that's that for him is that it's what emancipation means, and it's what freedom means too. Yeah.
Awesome, thanks.
Sure.
Since we're kind of on that note, I think me and a couple others were kind of also kind of trying to get our head around sort of the monarchy stuff, as you were putting it, sort of the advocation for the monarchy. Is it, how do I frame this? It's kind of hard to imagine that sort of in the contemporary world, like anything that it would even look like that. So I was wondering if you had like a concrete vision for that, or do you think there's just sort of like an idea behind it that Hegel is trying to put forward that you think we should still keep?
Well, I think the idea behind it is like what I will often think to myself is I do have a concrete vision, but I think the idea is also important that I think no monarch could read his discussion of the monarch and be feel good about that, right? Like the monarch is reduced. He even says the stupidest monarch is actually the best monarch, right? Like and the very contingency of monarchy, like it's the stupidity of birth that gives the power to the next monarch is a virtue of it, right? So he and it just like you cross the T's, you dot the I's. It's not like there's nothing you don't the monarch is basically stripped of any power. And I think it's like he thinks that that symbolic position is requisite for I think his idea is that it helps you avoid too much investment in an identification with the leader. And I think like when I mean, it's ironic because you think like, oh no, monarchy is about the investment in the leader. But I think he thinks it's actually a bulwark against that. But I guess maybe I don't mention this in the book, but I think the sort of the closest thing we have is this idea, and it's been developed by a couple different thinkers, Kojin Karatani and Japan and Jacques Rancière in France, I think, are the two main ones. This idea of like a lottery system to determine who the leader is, right? Like that, I think it nicely captures it gets rid of this like divine right idea associated with the monarch, but it captures the contingency of who's in charge. Like it just puts like someone, I think it's a nice contemporary equivalent of that Hegelian image of the monarch, because I agree with you that the monarch is a little bit untenable today. Although I think there are like Denmark maybe is a, I mean the British monarchy obviously has a lot of problems. But maybe there are some images that are still maybe tenable. But I think I like that idea of that I've always been drawn to that idea that Caritani and Rancière have of the drawing of lots to determine. But again, it's to show this. I mean, and then I think this is really crucial for Hegel to show the stupidity of the position at the top, right? Like that it's just an expression of that the real power is legislative, and the executive is just this purely contingent figure.
Thank you. Go
Yeah. I
ahead,
wonder if I
Chris.
can build on that
for 2 seconds here. Let's call it the state.
Yeah.
Is it an unfortunate necessity, or can people have freedom without the state? Yeah, I know that's a loaded question.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so this book made I have some friends that are moving in the direction of anarchism, and they did not like this book at all because it's a very statist book, and Hegel's a very statist philosopher. And I don't think, I mean, the question would be, I think, like, and this, I think the answer is more complex. Like it's not for Hegel, it's not necessarily like the bourgeois state as it is. It's like there has to, his idea is, I think, that there has to be some formal structure that then is the guarant is the structure that then one is subjected to, and then that is necessary for freedom. So I do think in this, if you define state in that way, then the state is not an unfortunate necessity. It's a beneficial necessity. It's like it gives us, because he doesn't think that there's just, because I think for him, there's not this sense of a kind of natural coming together. Instead, there's a natural, there's like contradiction instead, right? So it's not just that if it wasn't for some external authority, we would all get along. But it's also not true that some external authority allows us to all get along, which I think would be the Hobbes, some more Hobbesian vision of things. But without that, without that force of that collective, then I think the main problem with it for Hegel is that we would have this image of ourselves as an isolated subject, as somehow like sui generis and not dependent upon the collective. And he thinks this is why, I mean, this is one area where I'm very anti-Hegelian, but he was a proponent of, he thought war had a very, I think I mentioned this in the book, had a very heuristic effect, because it convinced people that their subjectivity was dependent upon the collective and not prior to it. And I think today it seems to me like most people think of themselves as isolated subjects, and then I mean, to me, the like Hegel before, I mean, it was just at the beginning of the vaccine, right? And he thought vaccines should be publicly mandated, because the public health for him was more important than like your private whims were first of all dependent upon the collective. So he was the first kind of anti-vaxxer, I think. So yeah, I think it would make him a very controversial figure today. I mean, a lot of people that I know are really, really that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, I think.
Yeah, and if you'll permit me to follow up for 2 seconds,
Sure.
I'm gonna shine the spotlight a little off of Hegel and a little more onto you right now, because you said, and I have the quote right here, if freedom manifests itself only as rebellion or resistance, it isn't freedom as such. And so I'm curious where you land on this in relation with the book, what you said early in the book versus what you said later in the book. I see them not quite aligning. I see the social aspect coming in, but there's more about this. If you need a little more, I can give you a little more. Maybe you have something to say here.
Yeah, I'm just curious where you see the movement in the book. I didn't feel that way, but so I'm
Okay.
curious.
No, and I may have been misreading too. So we had, I'll just back it up a little bit here. We had a
Okay.
lot of debate over the idea of your example is speed limits and laws and the relationship of freedom to some sort of law or limit.
Yeah.
And we never came to much of a conclusion here about that. And it seemed early on an argument was being set up for kind of what I just said. Freedom manifests itself through rebellion, et cetera, and it's not freedom as such. And then later in the book, which may not be a contradiction in my mind, it's a bit of one, but
Okay.
in the presence of someone smarter than me, it might make a lot more sense. I'm not seeing the bridges clearly, where it became the Hegelian idea of the social sort of takes care of everything, supersedes everything, and therefore there's freedom within that because of the social. So on one hand, I saw it more individual, and on the other hand, more social. But I personally wasn't sure if the social answered that question for
Yeah,
me.
no, that's really good. So I think that there could be some confusion on my part, but I think that, so I'll just be clear about what my position is. And I think it's proximate to Hegel's position as well. So I'm kind of answering both things at once, that I think that he does see the necessity of the collective, of the social law, et cetera. But the point is, and I think this is his conception of universality is really important here, that any kind of cultural social structure is always going to be particular, right? But it's precisely one's investment in the universal that lifts one out of one's particular identity, whatever cultural identity, whatever. And so that then gives you a singularity as a subject. So I think Hegel is very, while he sees the necessity of this, of the collective structure as formative of subjectivity, as the basis for subjectivity, even, he doesn't think that that exhausts subjectivity. In fact, like it's all, for him and for me too, it's all about the way that makes possible a singularity. But the point is, the singularity of the subject doesn't exist prior. It's not something that's prior and then is oppressed or repressed by the social structure. Instead, it's like a it's a it comes out of that collective moment. So I feel like, yeah, I'm really glad for this point of clarification, because I think that's it's not that the social takes care of everything, right? And that no, because freedom depends upon that, but then it's not exhausted in that. It's instead it's through one's like you it's not just like, oh, we have the freedom to obey the law. I mean, that's that would make Hegel into some kind of authoritarian or something, right? Like but no, it's that through this recognition that one then has the ability to then assert one's singularity, sometimes in opposition to the laws of the land, right? Like I think there's many cases where, I mean, the French Revolution's a good example, like and the Haitian Revolution as well, where he thought freedom depended upon countering the laws of the land. So I think it's not necessary. It's seeing that as constitutive, but then seeing that you then have the sometimes the obligation to break from that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a great line of thought, question.
I can jump in with a question. So this is probably a little bit more of a formal question, but I'd be interested to hear you talk a little bit about what you think the relationship is between contradiction and temporality for Hegel, or as you understand in the book. So the way that I So for me, there are moments in the book where you are talking about experience in relation to representations of in space and time in a sort of Kantian mode, but then it seems like, and this is only relative. This is relative to other people that I've been reading. Like Deleuze has this very sort of Baroque sort of three syntheses of time. Heidegger talks a lot about temporality and its relationship to finitude, etc. And there's a lot more sort of apparatus in there where. As from your reading here, it's sort of like there is space and time in representation, and then there is some kind of constitutive relationship between contradiction and time in some form, but it seems like it's I don't know, it's kind of played, and maybe there's reasons for that, or I don't know. So I'd just be curious to hear you talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think so what I would say to that is that I totally agree with your analysis of both Deleuze and Heidegger, and obviously in very different ways, but the way in which temporality is has a certain primacy for each of them, and that to think to prioritize thought relative to temporality is to make the mistake, like for Heidegger, that's what the mistake of metaphysics is. And for Deleuze, that's what the mistake of Western philosophy basically has been, except for some exceptions, like Bergson, I think would be an exception for him. Spinoza maybe, but that's dicey. But I think it's not an accident that those two, their real enemy is Hegel, right? Like, and I think they're right that he's their real enemy. Then and he's the one philosopher, like Deleuze is so interesting because he tries to everyone he encounters, even inclusive of Kant, he tries to integrate into his system to find a way to fit them into his system. And but the total exception is Hegel. Like Hegel, all he has is pejorative comments about Hegel and Heidegger, like the most unrewarding, like Heidegger has a great book on Kant. He has great analyses of Leibniz, and great discussion of Plato's Sophist, incredible discussion of Aristotle. But if you read what he writes about Hegel, it's not very rewarding. And I think the reason is precisely what you've hit on, is this different relationship to time, and that Hegel is really, and I think it's odd because one of the things that is Hegel's part of his reputation is that he's a philosopher of who introduced history. This guy Tom Rockmore says this: Hegel introduced history into philosophy, right? So it seems like Hegel is really the first philosopher of temporality. But I guess I want to say no. I think Heidegger and Deleuze are right to not to be suspicious of him, because for him, I think it's con that there's a primacy of contradiction, and that temporality is generated out of contradiction, not vice versa. Not that, and I think most, I don't want to make a claim about, oh, my reading of Hegel was so original, but I do think that on this, I'm at least a heterodox reader of Hegel, that I think most readers of Hegel say, well, he's a thinker of contradiction because he's a thinker of history or temporality. And I want to say, no, he's a thinker of contradiction, and that's how history and temporality emerge in his thought. And that's why I think I have a chapter on the philosophy of history, but I think philosophy of history, actually, I'm not sure people should even ever read that. Like, I feel like that's him trying to apply his thought to history in a way that's kind of haphazard and doesn't, and it's very late. He's already totally developed his system before he gives his first lectures, and all we have are student notes from his lectures. So I'm very dubious about the fact that we should take anything he says that is said in those as his words, because they're not his words, they're what students have written down. So there's that. But I think his idea is that there's a that contradiction is fundamental, and then time is our way of, in just like you said, in representation, our way in representation in Vorstellung, which is for him always, it's always a way of, it's not quite Begriff, right? It's a way of kind of getting away from the concept. So for him, representation is always like one might say, like an everyday way of thinking conceptually. So it misses something. And I feel like, so time and space, but time especially, like what we're talking about now, time is a representational way of grasping contradiction. But it's not like if something is taken out of time, it removes the contradiction. And I think that's the problem with thinkers that prioritize temporality, that they can only think of contradiction as a product of the temporality of something. Whereas for Hegel, the contradiction is inherent, and then that's why things appear as temporal to us. And so that for him, I mean, and I think this is where, again, Christianity comes in. Like, even God, the eternal, is contradictory, right? Like, so we can't even conceive of the eternal as self-identical, right? And so it doesn't matter. So time then is in a certain way misleading, because it leads us to think like, oh, the eternal doesn't suffer from this contradiction in the way that the temporal does. So that's what, so it's, I love this question, and I think it really kind of gets to what I think is the heart of the distinction between Hegel and this, for lack of a better word, because Deleuze isn't this, but like a phenomenological tradition in thought, right?
That's a great answer. More than once, I complained to this group that your writing and the way that you were describing things just felt like a kind of complex phase shifting away from Deleuze. It was not, and it was great for me to like to soften some of the more sort of populist readings where it's just sort of like a Deleuzian is never supposed to even look at Hegel or something like that, right? Like from reading this book and from talking this through and from hearing you talk, it's sort of like, yeah, there are like these issues are just conceptual, like down to like an angel on a pin or something like that, right? Like you really need to talk through the details of it in order to really understand what's at stake. And so I appreciate that answer a lot.
Yeah, I really think it's, I mean, I think that the opposition between them is a genuine one. Like, it's can't, and I think there have been these attempts to reconcile them, which I think are misguided, but I think it's also a fecund one. You know, like it kind of gives like look, thinking of them sort of at odds with each other reveals something about both philosophies, which is what you want, I think.
book, but couldn't be here today, unfortunately. I'm just going to pull it up and read it. So his question is relation to about the emancipatory potential of your reading of Hegel. So what might this look like moving into the future? How can it help us formulate a concrete opposition to global capitalism or to a post-Marxist communitarian option that could hold its own against capitalist hegemony?
You have 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. Like, I think I really on this question, I think Hegel's pretty definite that the task of theory really isn't it can't really point out alternative, like how we're supposed to structure an alternative. And I think, I mean, his very famous line that when philosophy paints its gray on gray, the political has already been decided. Then he says the owl of Minerva takes flight only at the falling of dusk, right? Like, I feel like he's pretty definite about that. I mean, I do have books where I write about this, but again, I'm not in a very concrete way because I really feel like these, I mean, I think I do think that certain. And I guess, I mean, Hegel is an idealist. I am an idealist on this thing. I think certain, like, we have to be guided by certain ideals, like certain, like the ideals, say, of the French and Haitian Revolution, that like, I think those ideals need to guide us. But I think that as they do, I don't think you can, I think it's a dangerous thing even to try to map out a path that we take. I think it has to be forged in the responses to the exigencies of the moment and the time and what seems like it's necessary, right? Like, I mean, the only thing I would say is I think that it can't, like, so you mentioned communitarian. I find communitarian very, I think that's a very dangerous word because I've never seen a community that doesn't have people that are on the outside of it, right? Like even these figures of supposed liberal inclusivity always need their basket of deplorables, right? That's on the outside. So I feel like that's a thing that's a little problematic for me. But I think it has to be universalist. I think that is a thing that Hegel is absolutely insistent upon. So I think that is one way that he can provide a kind of a guide, not in a very abstract way though, not in a concrete, like this is the manifesto that we can follow. But I think it has to be universalist because his idea is like, otherwise, if it's identitarian, then it necessarily is gonna, well, for one thing, he thinks it's gonna smuggle in, you know, like every position he thinks is universalist, whether it believes it is or not. Right. So I think that would be one reason why he would think it has to be explicitly universalist. So I guess that would be the, and then again, I think the other thing would be he thinks that any kind of community is like that's I think it comes back to that monarch question, right? Like the monarch is this very interesting figure because it allows us to see the stupidity of the figure of authority. And I think that I think like to and this kind of brings together Laurel and Chris's questions. Like, I feel like that understanding the stupidity of the figure of authority or the sort of nonsensical status, and yet recognizing its structural necessity and the structural necessity of this collectivity is like something like that is essential. So I again, but I'm very wary of like laying out certain prescriptions because I just don't think, I think you just never know. You know, like he has this great line where he says, you know, humans have never learned anything from history. And then that's what often gets quoted, that people have never learned anything, any lessons from history. But then the very next line is, and they're right not to, because every historical situation is completely particular and you can never really learn any lessons from it. So I think to me, that's like a really important idea. So that's a, sorry, that's a very unsatisfying answer, but at least the person isn't here to be unsatisfied. So,
So I'd like to follow up with that if I could
sure.
for 2 seconds, because I wondered if some of this if we keep digging, Len ends up in consequentialism.
I think there's something, Chris, it's an interesting question because there is something of a consequentialist in Hegel, like contra Kant, right? Like he really and for this, and I think we just have to think through it. I mean, I don't think it's exactly a consequentialist position, but I think it's proximate because all he does in his philosophy is take a position and then work through not what the position says about itself, but what it does, right? So there is, I think one could see that as consequentialism because he cares. He doesn't care like what your intention is. He doesn't, or the intention of a position is. Like, I mean, to me, he hated Stoicism more than any other position, right? It was, he absolutely hated, and especially like he uses the term in his letters. He uses the term monkish as an insult more than any other term. Like if you're a this monk, he would often say, this monkish retreat from the world, and that for him is just the worst absolute thing, which he would have interestingly accused when Heidegger refused the call to Berlin. I have a little thing on this. Hegel would have said this monkish retreat to Freiburg is ridiculous, right? Even though it was the Nazis that were calling him to Berlin. But I feel like the problem with Stoicism for him and this retreat from the world is that it doesn't recognize that it's actually producing certain things in its retreat. And it deceives itself like in that way. And it's actually helping to create the world that it has to retreat from and making the world worse so that it needs to be retreated from. So I feel like, yeah, I mean, I think that there is a kind of consequentialist dimension to Hegel's thought that is again completely opposed to that of Immanuel Kant. You couldn't have, there's I think that that's the that maybe is the break between them more than almost anything else. I guess I would distinguish it from a pure consequentialism in this sense that his point is not to just think like, oh, what is the result? Like, what is, but no, because he doesn't just say, oh, this person in history was like Marcus Aurelius was a Stoic. He led to Commodus as the Roman. So Stoicism is bad. No, he like takes the position itself and then follows its own logic to its end point. So I think that's not exactly just saying, like, what's the consequence? What is the result? Right? Like, I think it's a little different than that. But it is like following the logic to its to where it leads. So that in that sense, it is consequentialist. Yeah. But it's always it all his thought always considers. Like he's a real philosopher of, and this supports what you're saying. He's a philosopher of the end, not of the beginning. Like I think so many, and this is why this question of like, what do we do is so dicey from a Hegelian perspective, because he doesn't, he thinks we, that all thought is thought at the end point of a logical progression. And then you look backwards. You're always looking backwards to how something unfolds and develops, and then that's how you understand it. So yeah, I think that he can't, that's why he can't give advice. He's not, he, you know, no one, people don't come to him for advice. I just don't think he can do that. But that said, I think he can help us to understand where we are and what our situation is in a really help to me, a helpful way.
Hey, so I want to jump on a little statement that you said, which is that Hegel can be useful for figuring out where we are or the position that we're in. And in one of your chapters, I can't remember which one, you talk about Hegel's philosophy as being the return of the repressed. And so sometimes I'm curious how you would actually use Hegel to think in relation, like, since it is so psychoanalytical, like, you wouldn't use Freud's theories if you're going to a therapist, you know, and there's a sense where you can kind of put the cart ahead of the horse. So sometimes I worry about like your discussion of monarchy. You're also putting, in a sense, contradiction ahead of the horse. But anyway, I'd love to see how you
So
respond.
I'm not sure. Can you just unpack that a little bit for me? Like, what, monarchy puts the cart ahead of the
Yeah,
horses.
so I mean, there's a sense where in the figure of the monarch, it is almost intentionally contradictory, right? Where you're building contradiction into the idea of the government to begin with, where I think you can almost work backwards and see democracy as generating contradiction constitutively, and that would being almost like the playing out of the concept, right? So, and thinking of the phenomenology, right? There's so many ways where you can relate to your object, where you're either putting something into it or not giving yourself the ability to speak. And so I'm afraid that something like monarchy is also putting contradiction in the government before it has the opportunity to play out. Does
Right, but
that make sense?
yeah, that makes sense. Except, I mean, Hegel was living under a monarchy, right? So, like, he's analyzing his, in philosophy of right, he's analyzing his own governmental system and trying to see the way in which contradiction fits in there. So I don't think he was putting it in there. Except, again, he's like kind of coming after the fact, but I do think you're right. I mean, the point about democracy is really interesting. I think that there's a way in which, like, democracy, like the idea of the election, is this point of like contradiction, right? Where there's this moment of like total openness, where you don't know what can happen, anything can happen. And I think Hegel would really, I think that would that fits interestingly with Hegel's philosophy. I mean, his beef with, and I'll try to discuss this idea of repressed in a second, but his beef with democracy was, and he just in the forms that he saw it in, was that he thought that it tended to create people who saw themselves as just isolated subjects who had no sway at all, except their one vote that didn't really matter. And I think if you think about how people respond to the electoral system today, it seems like he's right about that. That there's some, I mean, I'm not saying it's, I mean, maybe it's the best system, I don't know, but I think he's right about the effect, the psychic effect that it has on people. But yeah, I think that he is trying to think there is this kind of, like, as you say, I mean, for me, the psychoanalytic dimension of Hegel's thought is really important, and he, in certain ways, I think are crucial. He anticipates Freud, and I think that, like, I the one thing I was going to say, like, in what sense are, like, is you could see, and I think I would see a certain the election and rise of these right-wing populist figures around the world as a part of this return of the repressed, and it seems like it's the repressed of this a kind of obscenity, right, that gets manifesting itself, and a kind of identification with that obscenity. I'm not sure how well Hegel thinks that, actually. Like, I'm not sure that he is the best thinker for that, for our contemporary situation, in so far in terms of right-wing populism in specific. Like, I don't know that he, I think it's a much more psychoanalytic problem that I'm not sure he has the just conceptual equipment to, just because he's a pre-Freudian thinker. I just don't know that he's that helpful about that. Like, and the way that we're, the way that the, and I think this is so important for understanding this, the way that the obscene transgression is it becomes a point of identification with the leader. Like, I think that that's even among people that are harmed by that leader, or would be harmed by that leader. I feel like that's a that to understand, and also the notion that seems to me incredibly important is this notion of the death drive, like the self-destructive drive. And I feel like that's not that Hegel doesn't really have a theory of that in the way that Freud does. So I again, I would just say that would be my thing about the contemporary political scene. I'm not sure how much. I think there are certain ways in which Hegel, like larger political structures and like what our larger political projects should be, I think he's pretty great on that. But I think just in terms of like our contemporary situation, I'm not that sanguine about how helpful Hegel really is, other than again this like insistence on contradiction against opposition. That's one of the things we're sold as opposition, right? Like again, opposition against immigrants or opposition in Hegel. For Hegel, it's like about internal contradiction, but that doesn't necessarily explain the rise of these figures that are preaching opposition.
Because you said the problem with insistence on particular difference is that this insistence, while it often appears in the guise of emancipatory politics, is actually the vehicle for oppressive social relations. It's the sort of thing, I personally would have loved to see you riff on for a number of pages, but you kind of dropped it and left it, and I'm like, wow. And this is completely Zizekian in a sense, because he speaks a lot about exactly that sort of thing, that what we consider to be normative is actually, high level ideology. I wondered if you'd like to expand on that here a little bit.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, I if there are similarities to Slavoj, they're definitely, I mean, that's definitely real. I mean, he's a good friend of mine and was very influential on this book. But yeah, I probably, I mean, I think I delve into this much more in University and Identity Politics, which was a book that kind of came out of this one. So I think that maybe that line, I kind of was like, oh, I should talk more about that. And then I did talk more about it. But yeah, I'm happy to talk more about it. Like, I feel like, so it seemed, I think it's easy to see why in a, that capital, that, and I think this comes, I think it's actually Frankfurt School that is the primary reason for this way of thinking, that capitalism and what they call instrumental reason imprints the stamp of sameness on everything, right? And so the idea became, and then I think there was a series of French thinkers that kind of picked this up as well, different in many ways, but similar in this way, that that sameness was the thing that was oppressive. And that we had to find a way to articulate difference in the face of that, and if we can articulate differences, then that's a way, that's a form of resistance to the capitalist hegemony. And I feel like a couple things about that. Like, I think that capitalism thrives on difference, actually. And I think that I kind of think instrumental reason isn't such a bad thing. Like, I feel like that it got a bad rap from Adorno, Horkheimer, and Marcuse, and I feel like it's that we could use a little more of it. And I feel like that the way in which difference functions within capitalism is utterly crucial to understanding why it works, and that if capital isn't constantly producing new apparent differences, then it's dying, it's failing. So, and the thing that it wants to re like the thing that it wants to avoid is the any articulation of universality. So I think that the one of the things that was a real, to me, important, and this is where I think Hegel's really utterly crucial for us today. So I said before, maybe he's not helpful in this one area, but then I think this area is really helpful, is that he sees the absolute necessity of thinking in terms of universality. And I feel like that's the thing that the capitalist structure cannot abide, that any kind of, that it's, that it seems, and I understand why the Frankfurt School was misled on this, because it seems like commodification is a universalizing thing. Like everything gets stamped with the commodity, like relationships, every object, everything that you have is thought of as a commodity. I get that how that seems universal, but it's a, I think it's always a pretension to universality and never actually is universal. That is, there's always this kind of movement in the direction of universe, but it never can be universal because it's always trying to achieve more. And I think so Hegel makes this distinction. I think it's so helpful for understanding how capitalism functions and how any kind of anti-capitalism has to function. And I talk about this in the book between what he calls the true infinite or the infinite of the concept and then what he calls the bad infinite and die schlechte und Endlichkeit, the bad infinite, right? And it often mistranslated as the spurious infinite because spurious suggests it's not true, but it is for him true. So the bad infinite is an infinite that goes on and on. It's what we usually think of infinity. It kind of goes on and on and on and on, never reaches an end. But for him, the infinite of the concept or the true infinite is like a circle. So it con it reaches its goal, but it keeps going and going and going and going. And I think the one is this is the perfect image of an anti-capitalist politics and society, that infinite of the true infinite of the circle. And then capitalism is always this bad infinite that keeps going and going and going, trying to reach universality, but never getting there. And so I think that's where I really think this that and then that's where all those differences fit in. So I think that like all those differences, like they can be easily accommodated within the capitalist structure, right? Like there's no limit on the number of differences. Like you can have all different kinds of Barbie dolls that are made into commodities, right? And there's no limit. There can be, there's infinite number of them, bad infinite number of them. But not that anything against Barbie, I liked the movie, but the infinite of the notion or the infinite of the concept, it doesn't like it already has achieved its goal. So it's not it's it actually does achieve its universality through, and I think this is the key thing, through its failure to be itself, right? So every difference, and this is what brings every different identity together, is every identity has a failure at the heart of it. And that's the universal bond for Hegel. And I think that's what's so great about him as a thinker, is it's not about, oh, we're all coming together as our complete identities, and then we merge together as a community or whatever. No, it's what holds us together is our shared failure, and that's what's universal about us. So I feel like that's where he that's why I think difference is for him overrated, I guess, to put it, or capitalists, right? And universality, or even I would even say sameness, is there something radical about that?
Feels like a good place to jump in with my other question, which was just to pick up on this idea that the role that failure plays in Hegel's thought. To me, the another thing sort of grated at me as I was reading this was that the account of the utility of contradiction travels down into things like animals and things into like how trees replicate themselves and things like that, right? Or how things are alive, right? And again, gesturing to people like Deleuze, other people like Simondon, where there's an account of pure difference, or there's a kind of bootstrapping sort of relational account that goes from, in the case of Simondon, like physical individuation up into how what a life form is like, up until like what a human mind is like, up into like what it's like to be in a society. To me, that's like this sort of tiering of difference that sort of starts from immanence and then terminates. And then in the case of Hegel, it's like contradiction is doing the work for all of these different sort of styles of difference, relational difference, right? And when you put it, like it's convincing when you describe it as like it's of course my body is failing, or that the tree is failing in its lack of nutrients or something like that, right? And so to me, that's like that makes sense. But I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about maybe the relationship between like what we might call vital individuation and Hegel's account of contradiction.
Yeah, that's really good. I think that to me is the like where the rubber hits the road in terms of like Hegel's relationship to other kinds of thinking. And I think it's interesting because right, like there's a certain kind of vitalism that sees a kind of natural fecundity to things. And for Hegel, there that doesn't exist. Like there's thing like all development for him is through the way in which things are at odds with themselves. And so that idea is absolutely crucial to him. And I feel like it's interesting because I think he, I so Slavoj, someone mentioned him, like he's right now writing a book on Hegel and quantum physics, and he has some like really like Carlo Rovelli, Sean Carroll, some like really serious people are reading it for him to make sure that it's not that he's what he's saying isn't totally stupid, because it's, you know, it's obviously you can't be an expert in Hegel and an expert in quantum physics at the same time. But I think that it's to me really interesting that the relationship between Hegel and quantum physics is much closer than the relation that there's a kind of relationship there. And then on the Deleuzian side, it's more like he's much more related, I think, to like biological think science, right?
Yeah,
So I think,
by the way that biology plays out and has a much
yeah, so I think
quicker,
it's really interesting. It's like these two different sciences almost have two different philosophies attached to them, right? Like I think Hegel, one of the things I like about him is that he allows us to understand the way in which, and of course he had no idea that this was true, that at all times, like what I am is con like we have a sense of like, oh, I am, or like the my this rock is this rock, or this tree is this tree, or I am myself. But I'm the molecules that make up that entity are constantly being like changing, right? Like there's some are being lost and some are being, and so that, I mean, he understood that. Just he talks about eating an apple, right? And he's like, his point is like, at what point is that apple is other to you, but at some point it's like it's part of you, right? Like you eat it, it's when does it start, when's it stop being other, and when's it, and his point is, well, you can't really say, right? Like that there is this constant. So he did kind of understand this molecular movement back and forth,
yeah,
because
it's almost like it's too much to ask because the science that you're describing, the science that we know now relative to what he was doing back
right, he
then.
had no idea of that. He just had no idea of that. But it is interesting that there were, like, Lamarck existed. There were evolutionary thinkers, and he rejected evolution. So there is this kind of resistance to a certain kind. I mean, he didn't know Darwin, obviously. There's a kind of resistance to biology, sort of implicit in his, or that by a certain kind of biological thinking about evolution, implicit in his thought. And I think it's because, but while there's a kind of like absolute embrace of like what would become modern physics, and I think it's interesting, like I hear this word all the time of flourishing, and I think to me that's the most anti-Hegelian way of thinking, because for him, like flourishing suggests a kind of like an inherent vitality, right? And for him, whatever vitality we have is due to this inner structure, inner fight, right? Conflict, right? And so, like, can he prove that? I guess that's the question. I mean, I think that's sort of at the basis of your question. And
Or
I think
like,
he.
what's the kind of like the kind of philosophical utility or conceptual utility of picking one over the other, I guess, is
Right.
where
I
I'm
mean,
at.
and I think here's what he would say. He would say, the fact that we can articulate, and he's deducing back, and your question is kind of on to this. Like, he's deducing back from subjectivity back to the natural world, right? Like,
Yeah, subjectivity is substance, like
it's
you
not
say.
the other way around, which it is, I think, for Deleuze probably, right? Or certain, there's a lot of thinkers for whom it's the other way around. Like, it's deducing, starting with the natural world, and then moving to humanity or subjectivity. But I think his idea is this, that if we're speaking beings. And then I think he's really taken, he thinks the most important moment in philosophy was when Kant articulates the antinomies of pure reason, that there are, that for Kant, and he doesn't even think Kant's proofs are right, but his point is that he's at least he's right that there are certain contradictions that are just insoluble for for human reason. And then Kant says, well, this just shows our reason is limited, and we need to think that we should not have put total faith in reason, and we should leave some space for faith, right? And we should limit ourselves to the understanding. And Hegel's point, he has this great line where he says, Kant has too much tenderness for things, right? And so his idea is like, if we, and I think you could argue with this, but his point is, if when we try to think the whole of things and we run into contradictions, that must mean that there are contradictions within things themselves. And that's the nature of his argument. So he thinks he's argue, I mean, I think you could say, like, well, wait a minute. I think the argument back to him would be, you're just talking about a phantasmatic realm of human thought, right? And so that's where your error is. But he would say, well, even that has to be made possible in some way, right? And so that would be his argument. And I think it's pretty, I find it convincing that if there wasn't contradiction in the world, then we would be able to think through the worldliness in a way that we are just unable to think through, right? Like, does the world have a beginning in space and time? And Kant's like, we can't think that. We shouldn't even ask that question, right? And Hegel's like, well, okay, then what does that suggest? It suggests that actually, like, beginning itself is the edge of, it's contradictory, right? Like, and I think it's pretty, I find that pretty convincing. So that's the, but that that is the, you're right.
Yeah, as like a toolkit for thinking, it absolutely is, right? And I think the book does a brilliant job of kind of exposing that on multiple layers. It's just, to be, I'm reading it and then reading this other stuff alongside each other was very, like you said before, it was productive, but also kind of like frustrating because you're trying to kind of square the circle
Yeah,
between
how do you square the
Kant
circle?
and
I don't know.
Hegel.
I don't think you can. So
Yeah,
that's the, I think that's the issue. Yeah.
Maybe I can go. I don't know. This might be a little left field. For one of my courses, we read the Ethics of Ambiguity before. And I one of the things that struck me with that is sort of, I mean, her interpretation of Hegel was, I mean, I think more in line with like the, the oneness, all that stuff, right? But I found that her philosophy or ethics of ambiguity was actually in a lot of ways very compatible with Hegel, and especially the way that sort of like you and Zizek talk about Hegel. So I was like wondering if you think there is any sort of like conversation between that kind of existentialism to be had or anything like that.
Absolutely. I think it's a great point you raise, because I think Beauvoir and Sartre were both the part of the problem is the 20th century, especially in France, was so like the shadow of Alexander Kojève over the understanding of Hegel is just is blinding. So yeah, this is an idea of oneness, this idea of like a coming to the end of history. The importance of the master-slave dialectic, even those terms, master-slave dialectic, which Hegel doesn't use, become the terms thanks to Kojève. So yeah, I think that it's not a great reading of Hegel, but I do think I'm pretty convinced that both Beauvoir in Ethics of Ambiguity and in Second Sex, and Sartre and Being and Nothingness, not, I think, later. I think Critique of Dialectical Reason is already getting away from this. I think kind of he gets sort of lost by Marxism and trying to somehow sustain existentialism within Marxism. I think he kind of gets sort of loses himself. But yeah, I think that there's a definite, I think my Hegel, I guess, is an existentialist Hegel, because I think he's just because of the importance of contradiction and the way in which one, like for him, like reconciliation, like I often think like reconciliation with contradiction, which I think is how, what he thinks of reconciliation as, is like that's sort of what Beauvoir and Sartre are trying to do. Like isn't Beauvoir's critique of patriarchy, isn't it saying like, look, you're not letting us be contradictory as women. Like that's what you created this identity of women as a being that is substantial and not a subject, right? And so, and like Hegel, I think he repeats five times in the preface to the Phenomenology, not just as substance, but also as subject, right? Like this, and I think that's what Beauvoir would say the exact same thing about, like, look, women is not just substance, she's also subject. And that's the thing that you're kind of deny, that patriarchy is denying us. So for her, for sure, and for Sartre, I think like this idea of being condemned to be free. I was just reading Teaching Existentialism as a Humanism, and I was just like, oh, wait a minute, this is just kind of Hegel's philosophy, in a sort of in a because Sartre says, and I think this is such a great Hegelian point. He's like, okay, you make a free decision, and then I mean, his idea of freedom, I think, is a little more naive than Hegel's, but okay. But he says, you make a free decision. You're not just responsible for your own decision. You're responsible for the entire world implied by that decision. So it's inherently universal. And so I think that's just a completely Hegelian position. So I really like what you're saying, that there's this kind of like real existentialist, proto-existentialist dimension to Hegel's thought that they didn't understand themselves because of this. Again, I wouldn't, I mean, I think Koshev's a great thinker. He's just not a Hegelian thinker, right? Like he's thinking something else. But I think that his shadow really unfortunately shaped France, and you know, it shaped, we were talking about Deleuze, it shaped Deleuze's reading of Hegel, as you know, everybody's, Derrida's, Foucault, everybody's. So hey, thank you so much for this. It was really fun. I had a great time chatting with everyone. I really
Awesome.
appreciate it.
Thanks so much for coming. And a year, I don't know, year and a half ago, I first read the Phenomenology. And every time I got to another chapter, I got to, first thing I did was listen to one of your episodes of Why Theory on it on the next chapter. So I appreciate you coming here too.
Of course, anytime. Take
All
care,
right. Yeah,
everyone.
you're this nation's co-ev. You're influencing a
Oh,
generation via the podcast. It's really great.
okay. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But all right.
Time will
Thanks a
tell.
lot, everyone. I'll
Great
talk to you.
listening to you,
All
Todd.
right, Todd.
See ya.
Thanks.
Okay.